It's been more than a century since Sherlock Holmes first captivated a generation of readers with his sleuthing adventures in and around London. And the character, created by Arthur Conan Doyle, has been stirring imaginations ever since. Over the years, he's been brought to life many times, on stage and on film. Some would argue Jeremy Brett gave the most effective interpretation of the famous detective in a British TV series which still airs on PBS.
What is the object of this circle of misery and violence and fear? It must have a purpose, or our universe has no meaning, and that is unthinkable. But what purpose?
Right now, Holmes is enjoying a resurgence in popularity, including this fall's release of The House of Silk, the first new Sherlock Holmes mystery to be authorized by Arthur Conan Doyle's estate. The House of Silk author, Anthony Horowitz, remembers exactly when his own fascination with Holmes began.
My father gave me the complete Sherlock Holmes for my 16th birthday present, and that's when I fell in love with the characters and the world.
What was it that you fell in love with? Do you know what it was?
I think it was the fact that it was so complete in itself. It's the fog, the cobblestones, the fire flickering, the River Thames, the sound of the Stradivarius, the strange villains. It's that extraordinary mix of gothic horror and romance and mysticism with sort of these two extraordinary characters.
Those two extraordinary characters, Holmes and his assistant Dr. John Watson, were creatures of Victorian England. But as much as Sherlock Holmes was shaped by the Victorian era, he also adapts easily to contemporary interpretations. Leslie Klinger is co-editor of A Study in Sherlock, a new collection of stories by writers like Neil Gaiman, Lee Child, and Laura Lippman. The stories, says Klinger, reveal the author's own Sherlockian obsessions.
Part of it is the time. Part of it is not the time, because we can see Sherlock Holmes plucked out of Victorian England and plopped down in the 21st century with the same effect.
Klinger is also the technical advisor for the latest Sherlock Holmes movies, including the just released A Game of Shadows. Though set in Victorian England, the movie has a very 21st century feel. Holmes and Watson have been transformed into action heroes, played by Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law.
I'm knee deep in the single most important case of my career.
What are we up against here?
The most formidable criminal mind in Europe.
Professor James Moriarty.
If we can stop him, we shall prevent the collapse of Western civilization. No pressure.
While the Sherlock Holmes played by Robert Downey Jr. may come off as an action hero tailor-made for the box office, Leslie Klinger says the original Holmes really was a tough guy.
If you read the stories carefully, you'll see that Holmes is an expert with the single stick, which is like fencing. He's also an amateur boxer. So those elements of the film are not invented. They're there in the original material.
And you think that the device of Sherlock Holmes being an action figure, you think they pull it off?
I do. I love the device that Guy Ritchie, the director, came up with of this, what he calls Holmes-a-vision, the slow motion battles where we see the wheels turning in Holmes's head as he thinks out every move he's going to make in a fist fight. That must be the way that Holmes would have done it.
First, distract target. Then block his blind jab. Counter with cross to left cheek. Discombobulate.
But Holmes as action hero is just one modern manifestation of the character. Laurie King, the other editor of A Study in Sherlock, also created her own contemporary version of Sherlock Holmes. Her character just happens to be a woman named Mary Russell.
I was interested in that mind. He is a misogynist. He is a misanthrope. He really doesn't much care for people because he is so much on the outside of most society. And yet he spends his life helping people. I was interested in what that mind would look like if it, instead of being in a Victorian male, if it were in a young feminist 20th century woman.
King says the character of Sherlock Holmes is so adaptable because he does, in fact, bridge two eras.
His tools that he used in the late 19th century were very, very modern. If you look at his forensic techniques, his investigative tools, They are things that are daily used by police departments around the world. In the Victorian era, they were cutting edge, and now they are the basis of what we do.
Do we even see the sort of legacy of Holmes in the TV shows like CSI and all these TV shows that are out there right now that are so interested in forensic science and crime?
I'm afraid so. There is nothing new. We owe it all to Arthur Conan Doyle.
Perhaps the most contemporary version of Sherlock Holmes can be seen in the BBC production Sherlock, which airs in this country on PBS. In it, we see a thoroughly wired Holmes, addicted to text messaging and taking advantage of all that 21st century technology has to offer. And just like in the original stories, when Holmes first meets him, Watson has just returned from a war in Afghanistan.
We don't know a thing about each other. I don't know where we're meeting. I don't even know your name.
I know you're an army doctor and you've been invalided home from Afghanistan. I know you've got a brother who's worried about you, but you won't go to him for help because you don't approve of him, possibly because he's an alcoholic, more likely because he recently walked out on his wife. And I know that your therapist thinks you're limp psychosomatic quite correctly, I'm afraid. It's enough to be going on with, don't you think? The name's Sherlock Holmes and the address is 221B Baker Street.
Afternoon. The thing about Sherlock Holmes, says Leslie Klinger, is that so many of the characteristics that make him fascinating are timeless.
He is driven by a pursuit for justice, but it's his own brand of justice. And I think part of us yearns to be like that, to be strong, independent, above worries about how we fit in with society. So I think it's a very appealing character.
In the end, says Laurie King, it's what Sherlock Holmes stands for that makes him such an enduringly popular character.
The driving pleasure in Holmes, the reason that we keep reading him and keep returning to him, is not so much that he outthinks everyone, but because he is this man who is consumed by the need to set things straight. He is a man who has given himself body and soul to the conquest of evil. And that is something that speaks to us across the ages.
Whether leaping from buildings in a 21st century action film, or reappearing in print in a brand new mystery, or inspiring a new generation of writers, Sherlock Holmes still thrives, solving crimes with Watson by his side and capturing a new audience that might even still be with him in the next century.
The anthologist Michael Sims has gathered a collection of suspenseful stories for Long Winter's Nights. His new book is called The Dead Witness, a connoisseur's collection of Victorian detective stories. Speaking to us from WQED in Pittsburgh, Michael Sims says he wanted to explore the idea of the detective and how that character evolved.
I wanted to have a few key historical significant things, such as, of course, Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes. But I didn't want to have just the old standard usual suspects. And so I looked for a lot of forgotten things by big name writers and then totally lost wonderful stories by people no one remembers.
Sherlock was not the first, and Conan Doyle was not the inventor of detectives who use the deductive methods of solving crimes. Who do you think ought to get that credit?
I think unquestionably it's Edgar Allan Poe with The Murders in the Rue Morgue that came out in 1841.
Now, in The Murders of the Rue Morgue, it's the locked room mystery. I mean, somebody is killed. They can't figure out how it happened because there doesn't seem to be any way in or out of the room where it appears to have happened. And the detective, Dupin, he thinks his way through this whole thing and explains it to his sidekick.
Yes. There had never been a character quite like this before. Voltaire had had a character who did very close scientific-type observation of the world around him. But really, Dupin is something like Victor Frankenstein, in a sense. He's very scientific. He's very much a romantic with a capital R kind of character. And really, Poe launched the entire genre with this idea a sort of genius-level amateur, because Dupin is not a policeman. He's not trained in crime-solving. And this same tradition would go through Miss Marple and Murder, She Wrote, that amateurs would have this arcane genius talent as if they were musicians or mathematicians or something. It's a hilarious idea if you stop to think about it.
You've included stories written by women and stories written about women in this book. I must say that I liked the Wilkie Collins story, which is early in the book. I guess that means it must be a very early example of a crime-solving female.
Yes, and she's not a professional detective, and she is really a character who also became very important in the history of the genre, who is an amateur who's caught up in the crime and works to solve it behind the scenes, either to help someone or to clear herself.
What's your sense of the women that you include in your anthology? Do you think that women who wrote about crime had a tough time of it? They weren't writing about women's subjects. There were a lot of women's magazines, and I think there was really thought to be a women's subject.
Definitely, definitely. I think a number of the women started out writing under male pseudonyms and things like that. In fact, the title story, The Dead Witness, appeared in 1866 in Australia, and it's by a young woman of, I think, Canadian-Irish descent. And she hid her gender behind neutral initials, WW, which secretly stood for her nickname for herself, Waif Wander.
I never heard of Violet Strange. who is described in the story. She looks down at her little white fluttering hands, weighted down by so many rings. I'm probably misquoting, but she's the opposite of tough.
Yes, and she plays that because Violet Strange was created by a very important woman in the history of crime writing, Anna Katharine Green, an American writer who published the first real detective novel by a woman. And she created Violet Strange toward the end of her career. And she is a New York socialite, very young, and she has to keep her detective work completely secret because all of her value as a detective is based upon her ability to go behind the scenes in Upper Crest, New York.
Tell me why I never have heard of Violet Strange. I mean, why is that? I pay a lot of attention to the Victorian period and to early detective writing and that sort of thing. I've never heard of her.
I think there's a very clearly demonstrated reason. I almost said a good reason, but it's certainly not a good reason. I discovered years ago that you can watch the male anthologists deliberately, gradually sidelined all of these strong, free, powerful, intelligent female detectives so that they were really mostly gone by the time the new acceptable version comes along, which is the Miss Marple type. You have little old women who are seen as harmless and not bothering anybody, and they're not seen as independent and strong, and they're not paid professionals. And you can see it in the early anthologies. You watch them slowly phase them out, and it's always male anthologists who are doing it.
Do you have a favorite in that group of women writers and writers writing about women? Is there somebody in there that you thought was sort of special?
I think my favorite is a short story called The Murder at Troyt's Hill. It's a woman named C.L. Perkis, Catherine Louisa Perkis. And she later became very, very important in animal rights in England. But she wrote a few books in the early years of her career. And she created a detective called Loveday Brooke. And she is the first professional female detective. She is not doing it for some secret, noble Victorian reason. Because one of the things that comes up a lot with female detectives is that the author has to explain away their tampering in such unladylike material as crime. And so they will invent a secret reason, such as they're helping a disowned sister. Or a really funny one, I think, is Dorcas Dean by George R. Sims. She was an actress, and she becomes a detective because her husband is an artist who goes blind. They would do anything to prove that their detective was ladylike. And Loveday Brooke, C.L. Perkis's detective, didn't have that. She's plain. She's ordinary looking. She's presented as very bright, a very respected, paid professional detective.
Michael Sims' newest collection of Victorian stories is about detectives, and it's called The Dead Witness. The Dead Witness. Michael Sims, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was fun.
It's time now for NPR's Backseat Book Club for our younger listeners. Each month, we select a book for kids to read and revel in, and we ask them to send us their questions for the author. Our own Michelle Norris explains why our December pick is perfect for a wintertime read.
This month, we invited readers to step into a modern-day fairy tale called Breadcrumbs. It features a fifth grader named Hazel. She was adopted as a baby from India, and she often feels misplaced, especially after her parents split up and she's forced to start at a new school. The one person who understands her best is her best friend, Jack, though he's facing his own family challenges. Hazel and Jack live in a snow-covered, hardscrabble Minneapolis neighborhood, and yet readers find their all-too-realistic world is also sparkling with magic and peril, especially when a woman dressed in white shows up making promises.
What if I told you that there was a place where there are extraordinary things, things with great power, things that could give you your heart's desire, things much bigger than this small, small world?
Breadcrumbs was written by Anne Ursu. You may know her from her popular Cronus Chronicles trilogy. Ursu confessed that Breadcrumbs was inspired in large part by her own childhood memories of winters in Minnesota.
So many of my memories of being a kid are sort of snow-coated. You know, the feeling of walking through the snow in your moon boots, and you have to, like, raise your foot like 2 feet in the air, and it takes about 10 minutes just to walk down the block.
This is in every way a winter tale, and there's something magical about that season that is apparent from the very first page, and you describe snow covering every inch of the ground in this neighborhood where the front yards are laid out like placemats.
Part of the genesis of this book came one January, and I saw a woman say, she had just come to Minnesota. She said everyone was making fun of her. Why would you go to Minnesota? It's a jillion degrees below zero, and there's 7 feet of snow. And she leaned in and said, I think magic is closer to the surface in the snow. And I love that line, and I wrote it down. I was like, this is something. There's something here. And I think that's true, and that when you're a kid and suddenly you look out the window and it's snowing, and that seems so magical, and the world just becomes something other, and everything is quiet, and it feels like it's almost your kingdom to go out and conquer.
That us against the world outlook is at the heart of Hazel and Jack's friendship.
They're two kids. They live in a lower middle class section of Minneapolis. Hazel's parents are divorced. Jack's mom is depressed. They go to a school that's right across from a Burger King, and so the playground smells like fast food sausage all the time. And I just wanted them to feel very real and sort of accidentally fall into this fairy tale.
Breadcrumbs was also inspired by the fairy tales Anne Ursu read as a kid, especially tales by Hans Christian Andersen. And in classic fairy tale form, all is not as it appears to be. There's the possibility of magic, but also mayhem. Remember that woman who comes bearing promises? She's a witch, and she lures Jack away into the woods. The White Witch prompted this question from one of our sharp-eyed book club members.
My name is Isabel Verdery, and I'm in sixth grade, and I'm 11 years old. My question was, did the White Witch from the story have anything to do with the White Witch from Narnia? Because they both offered the Turkish delight, and they were both in a white fly.
That is a great question. This book is based on Hans Christian Andersen's fable, The Snow Queen. And the character of The Snow Queen is a woman in white on a sleigh who lures a boy away. And so in The Chronicles of Narnia and Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Jadis, the White Witch, is very heavily influenced by the Snow Queen. So in my book, the White Witch offers Jack some Turkish delight sort of as a joke that she's referencing Narnia.
One of our readers noted that maybe if Jack read more that he would be aware that a woman wearing all white who offers Turkish delight is someone to be avoided.
This is why you should always read fantasy novels. They can save your life.
There are references to many fantasy novels and many fairy tales throughout this book. Let's hear from Kate Purdom.
I'm 11 years old and I'm in the sixth grade. And my question was, what made you have the idea to sort of intertwine all the different fairy tales into one story?
I knew going in that Hazel would be someone who lost herself in books and was always kind of lost in her imagination. And so she would have read everything and kind of interpreted her world through books. So Jack's mother is suffering from depression, and she says the mom looked like someone had severed her daemon, which is from The Golden Compass. Her very order-bound teacher, it looks like she came from Kamazot, the planet in A Wrinkle in Time. So those sort of ended up filtering in through Hazel's consciousness as I was telling the story. And then when I got to writing The Woods, it became this sort of fairy tale-like Hans Christian Andersen-ish world. What ended up happening when you look at Andersen's fairy tales is there's so much in there about sort of wanting and longing. And so the people in the woods, in the fairy tale woods, were all people who were really kind of longing for something.
You know, there is a sense of sadness in this book. You get a sense of a child moving forward, but always kind of looking longingly over their shoulder.
You know, I think I started writing Hazel, and I gave her all of these situations in which she would feel marginalized and other, and then took away her best friend, and that was who was her only anchor in the entire world. And so she felt suddenly and completely alone. And you know, you lose friends and you shed them along the way, and dealing with that sort of grief is such an essential part of growing up.
But you also gain wisdom.
You also gain wisdom. And it's one of the things I love about middle grade fiction is it seems to be really about kids kind of trying to figure out how to be in the world and deal with the world as the world is expanding and becoming more lawless all around them. And for Hazel, who begins with this very childlike notion of happy endings and ends believing less and less in fairy tales and more in the real world and in functioning in the real world, and that, you know, magic might not come and save the day, but magic can be created with memories, with a friendship, with a new friendship, with a baseball, with a pair of ballet shoes, but that's all, that the important thing about childhood is really, you know, continuing to grow and meet the challenges that face you, and that is the real happy ending.
Anne Ursu, it's been great talking to you. I am so glad that our path led us to Breadcrumbs.
Thank you so much. It's such a delight to be here. Thank you.
And for January, a story about a different kind of journey. The Backseat Book Club will be reading The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963, by Christopher Paul Curtis. You'll meet a hilarious 10-year-old named Kenny as his family heads to visit Grandma as the city of Birmingham explodes with violence. It's a story that beautifully weaves humor and history. And you can find out more by going to npr.org/books. Happy reading. I'm Michelle Norris. During the years before the Civil Rights Movement, a touring circuit known as the Chitlin' Circuit provided venues in segregated cities for hundreds of African-American musicians and eventually helped lead the way to rock and roll. Our rock historian, Ed Ward, has just read two books on the subject, Preston Lauterbach's The Chitlin' Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll, and Susan Whitehall's biography of Little Willie John, one of the Chitlin' Circuit's last stars.
Bronzeville, some of them were called, or Little Harlem. Others had very specific geographic names, like Deep Ellum or the Third Ward. And they had one thing in common, besides the fact that they were the black part of town. They all had the Stroll. It was the street where the bars were, the chicken and waffles or barbecue restaurants, the barber shops. Not all the local residents went there, of course, but on a Saturday night, you'd see lots of people out on the Stroll looking for entertainment. The chances were they'd find it. Where you have a ghetto, you usually also have entrepreneurialism, whether it be small-time crime or a neighborhood newspaper or a genius like Madam C.J. Walker, whose hair treatment empire brought millions of dollars into Indianapolis's black community in the first half of the 20th century. but there aren't many Madam Walkers in any community, and the average black entrepreneur in the 1930s was more likely to be thinking in terms of entertainment. And this is the subject of Preston Lauterbach's remarkable book, The Chitlin' Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll. Lauterbach has resurrected the names and careers of men and women, and yes, some of the toughest of these people were women, who ran bars, booking agencies, and clubs, where traveling musicians could come into a black community, play, make money, and go to the next town. This has been going on forever, of course, but turning it into an organized thing, and including smaller jobs in unlikely places like North Dakota and Minnesota, was the innovation, as well as providing venues for such forgotten organizations as Diddy Bo Hill and his 11 Clouds of Joy, or Smiling Billy Stewart and his Celery City Serenaders. No, the music these bands played wasn't giving Duke Ellington sleepless nights, but it was making audiences happy and making money for the bands and the places they played. Lauterbach's book traces the careers of now-forgotten people like Walter Barnes, who not only headed a band called the Royal Creolians, who barnstormed through some of Black America's more obscure backwaters, but wrote a column for the Black Chicago Defender newspaper, in which he not only hyped his band, but also the agents and club owners who were giving them gigs. He writes about a young man in Houston, Don Roby, who watched the Fergusons and others making mental notes until he made his move with his Bronze Peacock Club, Buffalo Booking Agency, and, trumping them all, the Duke, Peacock, Backbeat, and Songbird record labels, which recorded many of the top post-war Southern blues and rhythm and blues artists. It's a complex, multi-layered story, and a lot, probably most of the names, won't be familiar to modern readers, but the stories are gripping, and the Chitlin' Circuit illuminates a period of American musical history that's long needed it. Of course, the Chitlin' Circuit offered a platform for people who became famous, too, and one of them is the subject of a fine recent biography.
Talk to me. Talk to me.
John really did have, as the subtitle of Susan Whitehall's book has it, a fast life, mysterious death, and the birth of soul all wrapped up in his 30 years. He was born in one of Detroit's worst neighborhoods and used his ambition and astonishing talent to leave it as quickly as possible, sneaking out of his bedroom to sing in nightclubs at the age of 12. Before long, he was winning talent contests and attracting a couple of local guys, Harry Balk and Dave Usher, who were looking for someone to manage. They cut a novelty Christmas single on him and then took him to New York to get him a record deal. As Harry and Dave were relaxing in their hotel room watching Count Basie on TV, they heard a familiar sound. Willie had given them the slip and had talked the band leader, whom he knew from his Detroit appearances, into letting him sing a number. Before he was 18, he had his first hit single, All Around the World, and for a while he was unstoppable, particularly when in 1956 he had the song which gives Whitehall's book its name.
Give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning, fever all through the night. Listen,
Whitehall's a lifelong Detroiter, and this gives her book authority, so she knows who to interview and where they are. She expertly shows Willie interacting with the up-and-coming Motown artists in their circle. She also doesn't flinch in her depiction of Willie's demons taking over as he tried to fit into the new music, soul, which he did so much to pioneer. And her thorough research tells as much as can be determined at this late date about the night of October 17th to 18th, 1965, when a man named Kendall Roundtree was stabbed to death in a Seattle party house Willie was in. The subsequent events have the feeling of a classic tragedy, with a trial leading to a prison sentence, leading to Willie's death in 1968, the one mystery of his life which, due to inadequate records, Whitehall is unable to fully explain. Both of these books go a long ways towards illuminating the life black performers lived off stage and the conditions they endured while they worked. Things have changed since then, but the pioneering efforts of the Chitlin Circus great performers and business people, operating in a time when just being black was dangerous enough, shouldn't be forgotten.
William F. Buckley didn't just revive American conservatism, he defined it.
Firing Line with William F. Buckley, Jr.
For three decades, viewers watched Buckley interview everyone from Margaret Thatcher to Noam Chomsky on his TV program Firing Line. He founded National Review in 1955 and would go on to become one of the most famous conservative polemicists in America. Author Carl Bogus has written a new biography of Buckley. It's called William F. Buckley and the Rise of American Conservatism. And as Bogus explains, in 1950, Lionel Trilling, in his book The Liberal Imagination, wrote that conservatism as a force in American politics was moribund. Liberalism dominated.
And it pretty much had control of both political parties. Conservatism was really in disrepute. Lots of people thought that it was outdated, anachronistic, prehistoric, foolish, not very intelligent.
William F. Buckley really burst onto the scene shortly after he graduated from Yale University. He's a very young man. He wrote a book called God and Man at Yale. And that people often sort of trace the beginnings of the modern conservative movement to that event. Describe how significant it was.
It was incredibly significant. He was 26 years old. And he wrote a book which was about the economics and religion departments at Yale. And he criticized the economics department for being too collectivist and not sufficiently purist in laissez-faire ideology. And he said that the religion department was academically everything one could ask for, but that it did not proselytize Christianity. And he collapsed in that book religion, economics, and political ideology. He wrote the following two sentences, which may be his historically most important two sentences. He wrote, "I myself believe that the duel between Christianity and atheism is the most important in the world. I further believe that the struggle between individualism and collectivism is the same struggle reproduced on another level."
He managed, you write, to fuse elements of conservatism that we might identify today as neoconservatism, libertarianism, and social conservatism, and basically fuse those into what we now think of as the modern conservative movement.
That's exactly right. Today we think of conservatism as a coalition of those three schools of thought. It was Buckley who made that coalition. He held within him all three of those beliefs. He was what we today call a neoconservative, a social conservative, and a libertarian.
You know, I've been talking to people about this book recently, and without fail, everyone says, "Oh, William Buckley, I remember him fondly." People remember him and his program Firing Line that he hosted on public television for more than three decades. I just want to play a clip. This is he has on this particular episode Jack Kerouac as a guest, and Kerouac is clearly very, very drunk. Let's listen.
What's an Adam and Eve? What's Adamite? Where they all wear their hair long, lairs and caves?
Yeah, and sort of back to nature and
well, that's all right.
Exclusive concern for
you might have to in due time
measure.
After the Adamite bomb.
Hey, that was good, wasn't it?
Good all the time, boy.
Give that man a drink.
So this is clearly give that man a drink, he says. He knows Kerouac is drunk, and he's a difficult guest, and this is television. It's not easy, but he rolls with it. What was it about Buckley that people seemed to really connect with? I mean, here was this patrician, wealthy, snobby guy who used $100 words, and yet he had wide appeal.
Yes. I don't know whether I'd adopt the word snobby. He did have what people thought was an aristocratic bearing.
Elitist,
he did
maybe.
Have a elitist intellectual. We hear there from that clip his unique speech pattern.
His accent, yeah.
And something of his charm and panache, which were an important part of why people loved him. And also his playfulness. Mm-hmm. He was able to be both a very sharp advocate, but he somehow knew where the line was and was never mean-spirited.
And he could take it as good as he could give it. There was one episode of The Firing Line where he invites Huey Newton, at the time the co-founder of the Black Panther Party, onto the program. Buckley was, I think, fair to say, not sympathetic to that movement, or even, as I'll ask you in a bit, about civil rights. Before they begin, Huey Newton says, William F. Buckley, I want to ask you a question.
The question
here's
is,
what he asks.
During the Revolution of 1776, when the United States of America broke away from England, my friend would like to know, what side would you have been on during that time?
I think probably I would have been on the side of George Washington. I'm not absolutely sure. On the whole, I'm against revolutions. Well, yeah, I think as revolutions go, that was a pretty humane one.
Yeah, you're not such a bad guy after all.
It's absolutely amazing to hear that. Huey Newton saying, which side would you be on during the revolution? Essentially saying, you are a traditionalist, you're a conservative, you don't believe in change, and he goes on as referring to the civil rights movement and so on. And Buckley acknowledges that maybe, in fact, he would have been on the side of the loyalists during the Revolutionary War.
It is a remarkable exchange. We see Buckley's honesty there, his candor, and his being uncertain in some ways about where his own philosophy might have led him or might lead him.
It has to be said, in talking about National Review, that it was indeed on the wrong side of the civil rights movement. Buckley later on in his life changed his mind, admitted he was wrong. But the magazine in its early days was staunchly opposed to desegregation in the South. Buckley had written a famous editorial where he called whites more advanced.
Yes, the magazine is, from today's perspective, quite shocking on its views about race. However, while he said, this was a mistake on my part, he did not much dwell on it. One has a hard time finding the places where he apologized for his views on the civil rights movement.
What do you think the country would look like today had William F. Buckley not existed? Do you think there would have been a conservative revival?
Doing counterfactual history is treacherous. I do think that there would have been some kind of conservative revival because conservatism, broadly speaking, is an important part of the American psyche. But I think all that can be said is this. Had it not been for Buckley, conservatism would not be what it is today. And when we say the word conservatism, we'd be thinking about something else.
That's Carl Bogus. He's the author of the new book, Buckley, William F. Buckley and the Rise of American Conservatism. He also teaches law at Roger Williams University. Carl Bogus, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
In his lifetime, the writer Christopher Hitchens fixed his devastating gaze on the likes of Henry Kissinger, the Clintons, and even Mother Teresa. When he wrote about public figures and politics, people listened. But his most lasting legacy may be his atheism. Hitchens died yesterday of esophageal cancer at age 62. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty has this story about his long duel with what he considered the world's most dangerous threat, religion.
It was not trauma or disillusion that propelled Christopher Hitchens into a life of unbelief. It was Mrs. Jean Watts, who taught nature class at Hitchens boarding school when he was 9 years old. In a C-SPAN interview, he said Mrs. Watts explained that God had made the grass and the leaves green as a gift to mankind.
And she said this is an excellent thing and proof of the glory of God, because he could have made the vegetation orange. Or red, or something that would really clash with our eyes, whereas green is the most restful color for our eyes. And I sat there in my little corduroy shorts and I thought, that's absolute nonsense.
From that moment, Hitchens began a lifelong battle with a God he did not believe in.
I think deep down, he understood that this was the most crucial question.
Christopher Hitchens' younger brother, Peter.
Is man the creation of a benevolent God in an ordered universe, or is he entirely on his own? And all the things that flow from that. And he'd spotted it as being the fundamental question and decided to pursue it.
Over the next few years, Hitchens discovered that words could function as weapons, as he put it. He honed his skills in Oxford and later in the United States as a writer and debater. His antipathy toward religion became intensely personal in 1989, after the Ayatollah Khomeini declared that Salman Rushdie should be killed for writing his book, The Satanic Verses. Rushdie was a close friend, and Hitchens told NPR, that fatwa persuaded him that Islamic fundamentalism was an urgent menace.
In other words, money offered in public by a theocratic leader to suborn the murder of a novelist. A pretty extreme challenge to all the things that I like, from all the things that I hate.
It was not merely Islamic fundamentalism that worried Hitchens. He viewed all believers as deluded at best and fanatical at worst, even the saints. And so, in typical Hitchens fashion, his next target was an icon.
What makes Teresa of Calcutta so divine?
In his documentary about Mother Teresa and his 1995 book entitled Missionary Position, Hitchens reviled the diminutive nun as an ambitious self-promoter who took money from dictators and criminals. Here's how he described her to NPR shortly after her death.
Mother Teresa, a very important figure, it seems to me, to expose as a, what she was, a fanatic, a fundamentalist, and a fraud. She was someone whose net effect was to make more people more poor and more miserable and more wretched.
You know, I mean, a lot of us are sort of like, yeah, it's Mother Teresa. Leave her alone. What are you going to do?
Jeffrey Goldberg was a close friend and colleague.
When that Mother Teresa book came out, I thought, who next? The Dalai Lama, Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, God?
Yes. God. With his 2007 book, God is Not Great, Hitchens became a voice for a growing atheist movement. He delighted crowds like this one at a book signing in Washington, D.C., ridiculing believers for rejoicing in an omniscient, omnipotent God when he said the reign of this supposed God is akin to North Korea.
An absolutely impermeable dictatorship that couldn't even be criticized, let alone overthrown, that went on forever, that supervised and invigilated your every waking moment and would not stop torturing you even after you were dead. To wish this to be true is to wish to be a slave.
God is Not Great became an instant bestseller and catapulted Hitchens from a highly regarded intellectual to an international sensation.
I would say that Hitchens became the most well-known atheist in America.
Dinesh D'Souza, president of the Evangelical King's College in New York, was one of a few religious believers who dared to debate Hitchens. By all accounts, Hitchens was a devastating debater, seizing on logical weaknesses and often dominating the conversation with his words and his Oxford accent. Listen to this exchange at the University of Colorado in 2009, when D'Souza was trying to explain the difference between Christian and Islamic views of morality.
In Christianity, you have the idea, for example, that morality is intentional. If you've contemplated the sin, Christ says, in a sense, you've committed it.
Thought crime.
The mullah doesn't...
Totalitarianism again. Thought crime.
Whether it is or not...
We know what you're thinking, and we can punish you for it. Totalitarianism defined.
He was sort of a bomb thrower, and he relied, in a sense, on shoot-from-the-hip type of arguments.
But D'Souza says he's debated a lot of atheists, and Hitchens was his favorite.
His joie de vivre made him stand out among atheists. He was a happy atheist. So he was able somehow to communicate both that effervescence and at the same time to convey a certain depth that underneath it all, he was a serious man.
But soon, that energy would begin to ebb. In June 2010, Hitchens awakened one morning barely able to breathe. Thus began his journey, as he put it, across the stark frontier that marks off the land of malady. As he chronicled his cancer on the pages of Vanity Fair, Hitchens received thousands of letters and emails. Many said they were praying for him, that he would recover, or that he would accept God. He told television interviewer Charlie Rose that he was flattered, even though he thought the prayers were silly.
In the soft form it's offered to me, we pray either that you get better or that you see the light. What's the harm? It's like holy water. It can't burn you.
The disease marked a new stage in Christopher Hitchens' public atheism, with religious believers fervently hoping the cancer would convert him, and Hitchens insisting that he was unwilling, no, incapable, of believing in the supernatural.
Under no persuasion could I be made to believe that a human sacrifice several thousand years ago vicariously redeems me from sin. Nothing could persuade me that that was true, or moral, by the way. It's white noise to me.
Jeffrey Goldberg says as Hitchens' health failed, he made a preemptive strike against those who might claim he had a deathbed conversion.
One of the things he said to me and other people was, if I lose my faculties, defend my reputation as an atheist. Basically, he said, if, God forbid, I say something about believing in God, will you please go out there and say, look, this is the medication, this is dementia, this is not the Hitchens that we know.
The Hitchens he knew, Goldberg says, loved wine and friendship and debating the existential questions. As to his early death, Hitchens once said, I've been dealt a good hand by the cosmos, which doesn't know I'm here and won't know when I'm gone. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.